Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Embrace blue-collar patriots, suck up middle-class Democrats, celebrate multiculturalism. The time is now, declares journalist and political pundit Andrew Sullivan, for conservatives to get their act together, put internal squabbles aside, and win over the hearts and minds of liberal America. In this hour, what conservatives should learn from 9/11, Andrew Sullivan's wake-up call. But first, unwrapping the economic reality of the holiday shopping season. Earlier, I spoke with the Wall Street Journal's Amy Merrick and asked how it added up for retailers.
Well, we just got a little bit of good news in the last couple of days. Walmart came out and said that they are going to be at the upper end of what they expected for the holiday season. And Target also said that they're doing a little bit better than they expected for the holidays. But what's important to keep in mind is that those plans were pretty conservative. Retailers knew going into the season that they were going to have a pretty rough year, just as they have all year. So they're doing a little bit better than they expected, but those were plans that had been scaled back a lot.
And you're really only mentioning two large discount chains. I don't know how much of the retail world they make up, but what about the rest of that world?
Well, Walmart by itself makes up a whole lot of the retail world, but you're right. The discounters are really the people who benefited the most from the holiday shopping season. Department stores and specialty retailers, especially apparel stores, had a really tough time. There were a lot of discounts out there, and even those discounts failed to bring in shoppers to a number of places.
And what kind of stores in particular? You mentioned apparel. Are there particular brands who we know are in trouble?
Well, we know that Gap has had a very tough time this year. Their holiday has been a tough time. They've been trying to come up with as many discounts as they can to get people in the store, but it just hasn't been enough.
What's going on with Gap, Amy? It was such a hot brand for a decade. What's the problem now?
Well, Gap was really good at coming up with basic things that people were comfortable in that were good for the casual workplace. Mm-hmm. But a lot of people started copying their model, and people like Target and Kohl's figured out what they did and started doing it at lower prices. So Gap tried to evolve and become more of a fashion company, be a little more cutting edge. But that's not something that they've had a lot of experience with historically. So it's taken some time for them to figure out what they need to do to evolve. And as they do that, their core customers have gotten confused about what they're going to find at a Gap store.
Mm-hmm. And more generally, do you expect that we'll see closings of some stores or chains as a result of these disappointing numbers?
You know, I think in the next year, there may be a shakeout going on. That's typical in a recession period. And we've seen so much growth in the past few years with these retailers. The rising economy sort of lifted all stores. So there's a lot of competition, a lot of new stores have opened, and right now people aren't supporting all of those stores, so I think we will see some closings, and we may see some companies go out of business in the next year.
If there are closings, obviously it's hard for the retail store owners, it's hard for their employees. What else? Does it have ripple down effect for the shopping centers, for retail areas?
Absolutely. You know, mall operators have trouble. That affects what they can charge for rent. If they have vacancies, it's hard to attract even the companies that are doing well. Restaurants and things like that might be located in or around malls would also have trouble.
And what does the onward march of the giant discounters mean for the face of American retailing?
That's a really interesting question. I think it means that other stores have to understand that consumers are really looking for value. If those stores can't charge the lowest prices, if they can't be like a Walmart, they need to find ways to communicate through their merchandise or through store design that customers are really getting their money's worth. And I think that translates to product quality, creativity, and a really good shopping experience. So that if you can't distinguish yourself just by price, you need to find other ways to really make yourself stand out.
And what about the luxury end of the market this season, Amy?
Well, it's interesting. interesting because for a while, many people predicted that the luxury market would be immune to a downturn in the stock market. And we've really seen that that hasn't been the case. It's kind of been an inverse wealth effect. And those luxury retailers, especially high-end department stores, have been really struggling. So it'll be interesting to see what they can do to turn around next year. They can't really cut their prices too much because so much of that experience is the image and the cachet of those stores. They're searching right now.
And what are people projecting for next year to the extent that we can look ahead at all?
What I hear from a lot of analysts is that people are expecting a recovery in retail in the second half of the year, and that's sort of reflected in the stock prices. Retailers are doing probably better than you'd expect given the somewhat disappointing holiday season. So they're looking for sales to turn around, but it won't be in the next few months. It would be more towards the end of next year.
Amy, talk about credit card debt. How did the freewheeling and spending of even last year impact consumer spending and charging this holiday season?
Consumer debt is at all-time high levels, and part of that is the consumer spending of the past few years really fueled economic growth, and people were doing a lot of that with their credit cards. Now that people are more concerned about unemployment and job losses, that may make them more cautious about new spending and adding to those already high debt levels. We did see some pretty heavy credit card usage over the holidays, so that may keep up, but there is some concern that spending will pull back as people concentrate on those high debt levels.
And what about the role of September 11th and even this fall and winter's unusual weather in retail sales?
Well, as far as September 11th, you know, I think that's added to the general uncertainty that people have about the economy. And the other thing that it's done is that people were, I've heard, looking for more meaningful Christmases this year. Maybe not spending more on gifts, but maybe spending more time with their families. We saw home retailers, people like Bed Bath & Beyond, doing well over the holidays because people were in their home surroundings more, traveling less, and wanted to make those environments a better place. As far as the weather goes, the weather was really disastrous for especially apparel retailers. It was nice for me because I'm in Chicago and it was 50 degrees a few days before Christmas.
But too warm to sell sweaters.
Selling sweaters and coats was really tough, and that's why you see them half off in so many stores right now. They've got so much inventory and they've got to get it out of there so that they can pay to bring the spring merchandise in.
Which brings us back to markdowns. It sounds like that's what it's all about this year.
Absolutely, and there are great sales in the stores right now, I hear, if you want to get out and get some. Been a lot of discounting right up to the holidays, and this week between Christmas and New Year's, there's going to be a lot more.
Amy Merrick is a staff reporter for the Wall Street Journal. She spoke to us from Chicago. Tonight's guest, Andrew Sullivan, says the war on terror represents a huge risk and opportunity for American conservatism. Slip past hubris and squabbling, he says, and there's a virtual melting pot of leaning liberals, gays, American Muslims, and blue-collar 9/11 heroes ripe for the picking, ready to be brought into the grand old party. Is there a place for you now in the conservative tent? Has your political ideology changed since 9/11? Has 9/11 made you a conservative? You can join the conversation with Andrew Sullivan tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now from Washington is Andrew Sullivan. He's a senior editor at the New Republic and writes a daily column at andrewsullivan.com. Good evening, Andrew Sullivan.
Good evening.
With us also in the studio is special coverage news analyst Jack Beatty, a senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
Andrew Sullivan, you have written that the war on terrorism has highlighted and deepened tensions on the right. Why?
Well, it's a seismic event, and inevitably, when the conservative movement is as fractious and as vital and as alive as it is, inevitably it's going to bring up all sorts of issues and all sorts of debates, and they've been going on quietly behind the scenes, and conservatives have been looking forward to the future with both a great deal of optimism, but I think also some trepidation. You know, wars tend to move countries to the left.
Why?
Because the government inevitably takes on powers it wouldn't otherwise do. It's required to fight a war, mobilize populations, take on all sorts of obligations it didn't have to take on before. And that grows government, and also sometimes, if the war goes well, gives government greater respectability and prestige than it might otherwise have. And so you often have the sort of Churchill syndrome, where you have conservatives fight a war, and as soon as they've won it, the people say, OK, thanks very much. Now let's elect a Labour government or a Democratic Congress. And I think that's something that the administration is obviously deeply concerned about, and they're already scratching their heads and thinking quite hard about how to relaunch the domestic project with the State of the Union next month.
Mm. But Andrew Sullivan, we loved your characterization of the different nation-states, the factions within the conservative realm. But before we get to that, walk us through, in a nutshell, your basic analysis of the moment of opportunity and risk that the American conservative movement stands at now.
Well, I think the opportunity is really quite obvious. You have a president whose poll ratings are now really quite stratospheric. And actually, more than that, if you look at, for example, polling about who people most admire, this president now has something like 39%, which sounds little, but in fact is vastly higher than any other president in history. People have gone through an extremely difficult emotional time, mm-hmm. and they've bonded with this president, and he's rather calm, I think very energetic, and careful prosecution of the war. So that means you have a lot of good political capital, and there's a lot that you can expend on. On the other hand, you also have all sorts of splits emerging. You have what I might call the neoconservative element, which is very interventionist, very aggressive, very suspicious of the State Department, very suspicious of Colin Powell, mm. who have been carping against the administration during the war. They've quietened down the last couple of months once the war seemed to be going very well, but that divide is beneath the surface. Then you have the extraordinary powers that the Attorney General has taken on, which you can debate about, but there's no doubt that some parts of conservatism is extremely skeptical of the federal government, doesn't want it involved in mm-hmm. violating civil liberties. This is the sort of Rocky Mountain West libertarian conservatism that's very concerned. And so you have someone like Bob Barr, a major Republican figure in the House, taking on John Ashcroft on the question of things like military tribunals or detention of terrorists without due process.
Republican
versus
Republican. Another split
that you have.
Mm, yeah.
So that's, you know, there are all sorts of themes. And there's also, for example, the rather astonishing fact that black Americans now have very high ratings for George Bush, higher than any Republican president in recent memory has had, except for a brief moment during the Gulf War for his father. So that, again, is an interesting moment. Can Bush do what he's been trying to do for 2 years, which is remind African Americans, Muslim Americans, gay Americans, minority Americans, that he really is interested in their concerns, that he wants them to be part of this coalition that he is building under the banner of compassionate conservatism. And that's also very tricky. How do you translate wartime popularity into domestic politics, especially now, for example, that you see a stimulus package has failed and the politics of what we do next is not entirely clear.
Jack Beattie, it's a big tent that Andrew Sullivan wants to build here with a place for everybody in the Republican Party, if it can hang together. Do you see the nation going that way? Do you see conservatives able to open the doors to that tent and really call that population in?
Well, you know, just to look at it, the menu that Andrew laid out, I mean, blacks, African Americans, after Florida, it's going to be a very hard road to hoe for the Bush administration to make inroads there. And Bush himself, you know, this is he has a kind of situational charisma and popularity. There's no question about that. But this same man in August, same man September 10th, was really leading a party that seemed to have lost its way. I mean, and the public increasingly was seeing the Bush administration and Republicanism and conservatism as essentially the spokesperson, the vehicles of big business. And from energy to regulatory issues across the board, big business was getting everything it wanted, and what it wasn't getting, the very affluent were getting in their tax cuts. So, yes, we have a war leader who's competent here, and I think he's done a good job, and I'm especially glad that Colin Powell is there to tutor him. But I just think that we don't want to go too far with this idea of Bush's popularity and its enduring basis here.
Andrew Sullivan, we just have 40 seconds before the break, but what about the change 9/11? Do you think the Republican Party is changing as a result of that trauma?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the obvious signs is that what happened with the religious right, Jerry Falwell obviously put his foot in it in a fantastic way. Mm. And it's been discredited. Pat Robertson has quit as leader of the Christian Coalition. And
this is when they said that it was America's own fault for its moral decline that we invited this attack.
They basically sided with the Taliban in viewing America as completely morally corrupt. And if you put that together with, for example, the new GOP chairman, Mark Rusko, who is a very moderate man, you see that they are putting together the pieces to bring conservatism back. I don't think that it was in the dire straits that Jack says it was before September 11th, but
Andrew
I think
Sullivan,
building
we'll come,
on that legacy.
We've got to come to that after a break. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. We're talking about conservatism tonight. Has 9/11 made you a new conservatism? We'll be right back. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight with Andrew Sullivan about conservatives after 9/11, their new situation, their new risks and opportunities in the American body politic. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Will America emerge a more conservative nation after September 11th? And who carries your conservative flag? The neocons, the libertarians, the cultural pessimist conservatives, or some new faction, some new amalgamum? Join us. Andrew Sullivan, take us back into the factions that you described so well and dig in a little deeper with us. First of all, the neocons. You go after William Kristol, who we've talked with, for being too keen on the Colin Powell approach and at odds with the White House. How do you think that group is processing the lessons of post 9/11?
I think that I don't want to speak for them, but I do think that they, I think, misjudged this president. I think they kept mistaking this Bush for the previous Bush. They kept doubting his resolve to continue this war. They kept doubting his ability to take this war on from Afghanistan to other sources of terror and instability, such as Iraq and Somalia and so on. And I think that they've been proven wrong, and I think they know it, too, and they have adjusted subsequently. But that in itself is an interesting moment. You see, one of the big weaknesses of conservatives in the past has been a distrust between the conservative Republican establishment and some more neoconservative intellectuals. And I think what we might see is a bit of a reconciliation there now that this war has been prosecuted so effectively. And that will strengthen it. It was what tore apart, to some extent, the first Bush administration, and it doesn't seem to be happening with the second one. And that's an important intellectual fiber for this administration to continue with.
And the theocons, as you describe them, or the cultural pessimists who thought the country was going to hell in a handbasket, it was all Sodom and Gomorrah, you see them also has that view as having been refuted by the nation's response to September 11th.
Yeah, there was a kind of, I think, extreme pessimism among some conservatives, and they rather, I think, there came almost an anti-Americanism of the right, in which they viewed the problem with America as Americans. These people aren't moral enough. Mm-hmm. They don't, the abortion, homosexuality, the lack of patriotism, multiculturalism, they viewed it all as terrible. You know, Robert Bork wrote a book called Slouching Toward Gomorrah, which was, you know, one of his cheerier statements about where America was going. And I think they've really had a wake-up call. You know, this country's not as bad as they thought it was. Their disengagement from the country and the way in which some conservatives had disengaged from actually the ordinary lives of people and become rather abstract intellectuals scolding America, the sort of Ken Starr approach to conservatism, I think that's had a good kick. And I think that people realize that may be dying. And if it is dying, and I think it, along with the religious right, is dying, it's a very good sign for the vibrancy of a right-of-center coalition in this country that could really gain new strength from this. I must also say this, that foreign policy, we've learned a couple of things. We've learned the world is a really dangerous place. It still is. We've learned we need a strong military. We need strong defense. We need a strong intelligence. Not so long ago, during the Clinton years, we were talking about getting rid of the CIA. We were sitting around throwing a couple of cruise missiles in the way of bin Laden. We were slumbering under Clinton, actually fomenting to some extent the terrorist movement by not taking it seriously. And people, I think that means in itself, even if you were very liberal, I think people realize when those buildings fell, we can't afford to be that liberal anymore. The world is too dangerous. And I think that has strengthened the power of conservative ideas in this country. Conservatism, in some respects, is simply saying, look, whatever you want, this is reality. And we had a huge reality check on September 11th, and conservatism, as a result, is strengthened.
Jack Beattie, what about it? Do you think the humbling of the neocons and the theocons and the lessons of 9/11 make the Republican Party a more inviting place? Are they in a better position now to bring in a big majority?
Well, perhaps, but, you know, they have made a kind of devil's bargain with the market. Andrew writes, these are heady times for conservatism. The last 20 years have seen a decisive shift in the West toward market economics and away from statist intervention. And I want to go right at that, because to be on the side that, and Andrew's assumption, sort of the enabling premise of his piece, that to be on the side of Thatcher, Reagan, Bush economics is an unmitigated edge for conservatism and the GOP. Market triumphalism has its dangers for conservatism. The current crisis has shown us that markets aren't enough. It's markets that brought us air force security on the cheap. Markets left to themselves will destroy the biosphere. Markets can't bring health insurance to 40 million Americans, many of them full-time workers. Markets can't provide housing to the working poor, as Barbara Ehrenreich shows in her recent book on blue-collar work. Markets pit third-world peasants against American workers in a race to the bottom on wages that can only be stopped by a global New Deal that will guarantee labor rights to workers in the poor countries, something opposed theologically by conservatives. Free marketeers want to privatize the jobs of the public servants, union members to a man and a woman, the people who were the heroes of September 11th. The unregulated market brought us Enron. It's the market. Cultural liberalism that menaces family values. Pornography is a $10 billion industry. You know, someday the religiosity espoused by red America, you know, Bush America,
states
we
in the
saw,
middle.
Right, is going to come up hard against market economics. It could happen. You can't fool people with the bogeys of right-wing populism forever. And to bring this little Jeremiad to a close, the market spoke through one of the main organs of that party when the ineffable Dick Armey, the retiring House Majority Leader, said that while he favored a multi-billion-dollar bailout of airline corporations, any aid to laid-off airline workers could, quote, not be consistent with the American spirit. To latch your cause so unreservedly to the market with all these downsides and its negative effects on people, this is not necessarily a winning hand.
Andrew Sullivan, you've got our Jack Beattie in a high dudgeon here. You may be chewing your microphone there. Well, what about it?
Wow, it's forever 1976 in Boston, isn't it?
Oh, I mean, please.
It's like things have moved a little bit. Even the Democratic Party, of course.
We want to hear it. We're pushing on through to the other side. Tell us about it.
Just as it's forever 1776 in your brain with Adam Smith and the theory of how things ought to be.
It's
anyway,
back and
Andrew,
forth to the future here. Andrew Sullivan,
well,
have
happily,
at it.
Jack, your own party has recognized reality and embraced a large amount of market economics, and your own party put through welfare reform, your own party put through the North American Free Trade Agreement. Your own party and your former president pioneered free trade across the world and free markets at home, and presided over a fantastic increase in wealth for all Americans, including especially towards the end of the boom, poor and lower middle class Americans. So and what bin Laden targeted, of course, was exactly the free market in goods and services represented by the World Trade Center. These things don't pit people against anybody. What they do is they enable people to realize their own talents in a free society without being constrained and contorted by government power.
I don't think
is going to change. And I think the astonishing prosperity that was the function of the 90s, which was a function of markets, are things that have sunk in. I don't think that Republicans are going to move away from that. I do think that no one denies that the market needs government to come in and rescue it at times and help it at times and correct it at times. But I don't think that argument, I think, frankly, that argument's over. I think only on the far left do people want the government to come in and start re-regulating whole swaths of the economy. But I would say this, that yes, some public services clearly have been seen in a new light. I think we look at our firefighters now differently than we did before this. We look at our cops differently. And I think part of what conservatives have to say is, look, we do believe in government as well. We believe in a government that supports defense, that supports the military, that supports cops, law and order, security, intelligence. And one of the problems with the government in this country was it got so big and bloated, tried to do so many things, that it forgot to do its most important thing, which is to protect its citizens from a foreign attack. It was a fantastic failure of government that this happened. And I think that one thing that conservatives are going to say, I think what Bush is going to say in his State of the Union address is, we have to get back to the basics here with our government. Stop trying to throw large amounts of subsidies at all sorts of people and start trying to get our own house in order, make sure international security is secure, make sure our defense is working, and so on and so forth. In other words, I think you can make a pro-government conservative argument, which doesn't involve all the ideas of the 70s that Jack Beattie still believes in, and very few people other do.
No, they're just the ideals of the New Deal that helped to make the American middle class and to make my life and the life of many other Americans possible.
Jack Beattie, well, Andrew Sullivan, to your corners. We're going to bring some callers in here and let them have their way. We're at 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about the state of American conservatism. Will the Republican Party emerge a big winner or accidental loser if it falls to the splinters, Andrew Sullivan has described, from the war on terror? Will America emerge a more conservative nation after 9/11? We're at 1-800-423-8255. David is on the line. Hi, David.
Yes, good evening. You're talking to a libertarian objectivist Republican from Massachusetts.
Oh, that's a long label, and we hear it.
And that's a lonely position.
It's a very lonely position, and God bless you.
I am so glad I'm on tonight. I think that we're achieving a third level of Republican awareness here. The first level was the Reagan-Thatcher wave. The second, although nobody likes to talk about it, is the Newt Gingrich contract with America.
And now?
Changed us. And now we're talking about Americans who never realized that they were conservative Republicans, but I see flags all over my town and all over the country.
Does a flag make somebody a Republican, David?
No, a flag makes somebody an American. And I think right now we have to put ourselves together in the family of the American people and not pay attention to where we came from or what religion we are, but stand for our country.
But we are talking about parties, and are you suggesting, David, that this urge, this surge toward patriotism is going to bring a windfall to the Republican Party?
Well, I think the awareness comes from the fact that the American people really weren't concentrated on a lot of things until Republicans brought it to their attention. I think that the situation that we have now is based on the fact that we just didn't look at where the dangers were coming from. And I think the Republican Party has tried to concentrate on the fact that areas that we have interests in have to be protected. And
David, I want to ask you in particular, Andrew Sullivan says it's time for the Republican Party to be the big tent party, the multicultural party, to throw the doors open to American Muslims, blue-collar heroes of 9/11, to gays. Do you see the Republican Party embracing that opportunity as Andrew Sullivan describes it?
I do. I think that the situation, I look at Mayor Giuliani in New York, for instance. He managed to galvanize the people regardless of party, but the fact remains that his tenure as the mayor of New York kept him in the limelight and aware of what the people needed when something needed to happen.
David, thanks so much for your call. Andrew Sullivan, what about it? Do you see evidence the Republican Party may indeed adopt the big tent, the multicultural tent that you're proposing here?
Well, it's been happening for a while. You know, when Bush celebrated Ramadan, he was saying something important, and I think the president's been very careful throughout this to say, we are not against Islam, we are not against American Muslims, in fact, we welcome them into our party and into our country. And I think also what's happened is that you also have people like Condi Rice and Colin Powell, by far the most powerful African-Americans in American government ever, who have risen to this position of power and authority and respect under a Republican president. And that cannot help but be noticed by people, and especially, I hope, African Americans. You also see one of the themes of the 90s, one of the great themes of the Democratic Party, is that we're black first before American. We're gay first before American. We are all these different groups and ethnic identities are most important. We have to have affirmative action for everything. We have to label you this way. And suddenly we realize that doesn't matter. What matters is we all have an equal citizenship or an equal part in this country, an equal part in the project. And where we're actually from or what exactly our identity is doesn't matter so much. We should all be included, but we shouldn't make a huge deal out of it the way the Democratic Party does and has done historically. And I think that is a good opportunity if the Republican Party is smart enough to do it. Now, there are forces in the Republican Party that are still not like that, and they don't want to see gays in the party. They don't want to see blacks doing so well in the party. There are some residual bigots in there, and there's no question about that. But I do think the president isn't one of them. And I do think that kind of unifying moment can be a great thing, not just for the Republican Party, but for the whole society.
Andrew Sullivan, let's turn to the phones. Jay's on the line. Hi, Jay. You're on the air.
Hi, Andrew. How are you?
Good, very well. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. My question was this. There are a certain number of liberals in the country that I think decided to support the president and support his initiative based on the fact that we were going after a known terrorist, Osama bin Laden. And I think we're a little bit disappointed in the fact that we went into Afghanistan, waged a certain degree of war on them, but didn't hit the goal, so to speak. And I think we want to know what's going to happen. I mean, we want to support our president. We want to be patriots, but we're having an issue with the fact that this guy has escaped, basically.
Jay, thanks for your call. Andrew Sullivan, is this Bush 2? Is this the Saddam Hussein reprise?
Well, the short answer is we just don't know right now.
We don't know
whether he's dead already. We don't know where he is. But remember that the president was smart enough at the very beginning of all this to say, look, this isn't about one man. It isn't about one campaign. It is a war that's going to go on for many years. And it's not going to have a quick and easy victory. And it's all about crippling these terrorist networks and taking them out and showing countries that sponsor these terrorists that they cannot do so without some kind of attack or some kind of response. And I think that, the astonishing victory that's occurred, the lesson it's shown the rest of the world. I mean, Yemen, for example, is now cooperating in ferreting out its own al-Qaeda networks without our even doing anything. Now, if you'd said a year ago that Yemen would be doing that, you'd think you were smoking something. And the fact is that the example of American power, which has really impressed parts of the world that respect power, namely vast amounts of the Middle East, has already had an impact on the rest of the world. Now, is it a quick and easy victory? No. Are there huge problems ahead? Yes. If bin Laden reemerges somewhere else, clearly it's going to be problematic. But the terrorist state, the Taliban, Afghanistan, al-Qaeda terrorist state is over. And that is a big achievement. The idea that we'd be talking here just before, still in this 2001 and saying this is remarkable. I would never have predicted it this early. So I don't think it's all over yet at all. And I do think it could still go wrong. But I think the way in which Bush has set up the war, telling us to be patient, telling us it's going to take a long time, and the way in which he's rather calmly done it without bragging about every move, I think people trust him. And I think that trust is going to translate at some point into domestic policy unless the administration totally screws it up.
We're talking tonight with Andrew Sullivan, senior editor at The New Republic. He writes a daily column on his website, andrewsullivan.com. His article in the December 17th New Republic was What Conservatives Should Learn from 9/11. What about you? Are you a new conservative after 9/11? And will America emerge a more conservative nation from 9/11? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight with Andrew Sullivan, senior editor at The New Republic, about conservatism in the United States post 9/11. What do you think? Has 9/11 made you a new conservative, confirmed you as an old conservative, and is the whole country turning more conservative in the midst of the war on terror? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Michael is on the line. Welcome, Michael. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I'd say that people are a little bit less willing to think things through in the aftermath of 9/11. But
less willing in what respect, Michael?
I think that there's a general call to all pull together mm-hmm. and to take part in a great enterprise and to defend ourselves, which may have happened to us not because we were too strong, as a guest earlier this evening mm-hmm. was speaking of. Mm-hmm. But my basic point was that there will be reality testing at some point. As an example, yes, we're all supposed to come together and work together and be just Americans first. But if America appears to really be working not for very many of us, mm-hmm. then no matter how good it sounds, then I think some people may feel burned. Mm.
Michael, thanks for your call. Let's put it to Andrew Sullivan. This echoes some of Jack Beatty's point, Andrew Sullivan. The economy and the sharing the wealth does remain important even for Republicans, doesn't it?
Of course it does, and the recession is obviously a problem. I think people have grown up enough to know that, you know, the recession was coming before Bush came in. September 11th obviously made it worse. I think if you run against the Bush recession, you're actually going to do yourself more harm than good in politics. But by the same token, I would agree. What conservatives have to do is to say, we have to lower taxes for ordinary people, not just wealthy people. We have to remove the dead hand of government from people's lives in ways that can empower them and help them realize their own dreams. And that has to be a very broad appeal to people. And I think that we can. And I think that it has been done. And I think that once one takes some of the more cultural right-wing, religious right issues off the table, and I think they are slowly being taken off the table, then that broad argument for conservative opportunity, lower taxes, smaller government, greater control over your own lives, less government meddling in your lives, then I think that's going to be as powerful as it's been for the last two decades. And, you know, the era of big government is over, as who was it said that? I think it was Bill Clinton said that. I think that that's there for the picking. But, yes, I do think, obviously, if the recession gets worse, if something like the stimulus package, which didn't get through, I'm glad it didn't, given what was in it. But if the economy seems to be struggling still, then there is going to be a real problem. And I think the administration has been very, very alarmed at the possibility that could happen.
Let's try and get another call in before our clock runs down. Al is on the line. Welcome, Al. You're on the air.
Thank you. My question to Mr. Sullivan is this. Prior to 9/11, the Republican Party and your publication had been leaning towards an isolationist approach where hands off the Middle East, let's not get involved in international affairs, let's keep our troops out of Eastern Europe and Bosnia. And after 9/11, similar to December 7, 1941, the Republican Party had been isolationist then as well. Now all of a sudden it's saying, okay, we're going to get involved in the Middle East. We advocate a Palestinian state. Let's get our troops over here and do some nation building. Is this a temporary shift in the Republican Party and it's going to go back to an isolationist stance, or is this a more permanent, more pragmatic approach?
Good question, Al. Thank you very much. Andrew Sullivan.
Well, I'm sorry to say I really don't agree that the Republican Party was isolationist in the previous election. Bush does not come from an isolationist.
But we did see him in all the campaign appearances saying we should pull back, we shouldn't get involved in this peacekeeping stuff, we shouldn't be here and there.
And we still aren't. Who's doing the peacekeeping in Afghanistan? Sure isn't the United States. The Brits are going in there. Other countries are going in there. The United States has not shifted. The Republican Party hasn't shifted towards saying our soldiers need to go in to create nations and keep peace. The job of the superpower is to go in and fight wars and win them, and other people can come in and build the nations if they want to or if they can. Again, in the Middle East, Bush hasn't changed his policy. In fact, even more so now, he is firmly pro-Israel and actually hands off from Arafat. He hasn't even met Arafat. So I think there hasn't been a huge change. It was a more modest approach to foreign policy than the Clinton view, which was that we should send troops all sorts of places where we don't have vital national interests to do good. And I don't see that shifting. But I think also people realize that just because you don't believe in peacekeeping in that sense doesn't mean you're isolationist. In fact, you should be very strongly interventionist. And anybody that has Colin Powell as their secretary of state, or has Dick Cheney there as defense secretary, these people are not isolationists. These people were in the Gulf War. Neither is that part of the Republican Party that preeminent. Insofar as that did exist in the Republican Party and there was a growing Buchananite feel that we should withdraw from the world, then I hope to God it has been defeated by this particular event. But I don't think that it was that strong, and I think that this isn't a huge change in Bush's original strategy.
And we've just got a few seconds left, Andrew Sullivan, but you say that Iraq may still be a tripwire on this front, that how fast or slow the Republicans, the White House, addresses Iraq could still tear the Republican Party apart, at least in
part. Oh, yeah, I think it is. I think it's the next big issue, and I think you can already feel that there will be extraordinary impatience in conservative Republican ranks if we do not aim for one of the prime sources of terror. But I'm told, quite, you know, by with very good sources, that this isn't even in debate being debated in the administration. There is no debate about whether we go after Iraq. The debate is merely about how and when. And I think that the performance of the administration so far has been good enough to build enough trust to make that not explode. But yes, down the line, if this does unravel, sure, all these things will come up again and the divisions will grow again. So nothing's stable in politics, and all I'm arguing really is there's an opportunity now, if Bush can seize it, to take his popularity and embrace a more multicultural America within basic conservative principles. And I think, I actually believe he's up to the task, but, you know, only I can't predict that, and no one knows, and I could be completely wrong.
Andrew Sullivan, we thank you very much for joining us tonight.
You're very welcome. It's always great to be on WBUR.
Good to have you.
It is.
Andrew Sullivan is senior editor at The New Republic. He writes a daily column on his website, andrewsullivan.com. And Jack Beatty, from your facial expression, I'm not sure you're fully persuaded.
Well, I've been biting my tongue here. I do enjoy Andrew, but he did use that hoary cliche, dead hand of government. Imagine the dead hand of government weighing on that minimum wage worker, you know, whose job is without health insurance, whose job is threatened by free trade. Oh, government. It must be such a burden on him. These cliches are part of what is the problem with the Republican Party. This is a party, you know, what did Emerson say? This is the stupid party. We don't think. applying mind to politics
now,
is
now, don't pull any
heresy.
Punches, Jeff. I did see you smiling a little bit when Andrew talked about lower taxes for all, not just the rich.
Yes, it would help. But, you know, lower taxes isn't going to do it for the guy who's got to get his kid educated, who wants his environment clean, who wants the streets to be safe and so on. We're all together here. And I think that's the message of a war. When we're all together, government, we recognize, is us.
But, Jack, are you so sure that the Republican Party, in fact, in spite of your perspective there, might not profit from this surge of patriotism, this rally around the war effort?
Of course it could. Of course it could. But it's fighting long-term historical problems with political coalitions, with the president's party. They hold on only by 6 seats in the House. They've lost the Senate. It's very hard for a president to transfer his popularity. And the House Republicans, you know, they're not talking about a gentler, unifying big tent. They're talking about a party of, you know, gun owners and people that want to rip off the environment and corporations and rich people. I don't hear anything about gays. I don't hear anything about African Americans. I certainly don't hear anything about Hispanics. They're all opposed to, bilingual education as if it's some sort of plot against the native Heath. So, no, I think there are a lot of problems in this party.
Jack, I'm sorry you don't have any opinions on this, but we have to come back and face that vacuum some more. We've got a little tape I want to listen to here that's interesting. This morning, Rudy Giuliani said goodbye to the office of the mayor of New York City. Speaking at St. Paul's Chapel, one block east of the ruins of the World Trade Center, Time Magazine's Person of the Year reviewed the changes his administration brought to the city and spoke of the chapel as a metaphor for the resilience of New Yorkers. Here are excerpts from this morning's farewell address.
This chapel is thrice hallowed ground. It was consecrated as a house of God in 1766. That's a long time ago. And then in 1789, in April of 1789, George Washington came, and after he was inaugurated as the first president of our republic, he prayed right here in this church. But then it was consecrated one more time on September 11th. This church existed for many years in the shadow of the Twin Towers. And on September 11, when the Twin Towers were viciously attacked and came crashing to the ground, destroyed buildings all around, and covered this whole area with debris, body parts, this chapel remain not only not destroyed, not a single window was broken, not a single thing hurt. And I think there's some very, very special significance in that. The place where George Washington prayed when he first became President of the United States stood strong, powerful, untouched, undaunted by the attacks of these people who hate what we stand for. Because what we stand for is so much stronger than they are. You know, our enemies insanely commit suicide. They used to think that we're afraid to die for what we believe in. And the reality is that we don't want to die. And we don't believe that it's our right to make that choice for ourselves. We think God only has that right. But the reality is that we're just a few blocks from a site in which hundreds and hundreds of men and women freely, by choice, gave up their life, first to protect the lives of other people, and secondly, to preserve the dignity and honor of the United States of America while under attack. We're in a very holy place, and we're really on territory that is hallowed in very special ways. Never before, I don't think, in the history of America, so many people died and then ended up saving so many people. So I really believe we shouldn't think about this site out there, right beyond us, right here, as a site for economic development. I think we should think about it this way. We should think about how we can find the most creative minds possible. And we should think about a soaring, monumental, beautiful memorial that just draws millions of people here to just want to see it. Thousands of people died there, and hundreds of them died as rescue workers. They didn't have to go there. They walked in to try to pull people out. Some of them are very close friends of mine, and some of them are very close friends of people that I love and care about. And I'm a survivor like the church is. They got us out, and we survived. The building could have fallen in a different way. We could have decided to stay somewhere else, and then we wouldn't be here today. So I think we have an obligation to the people who did die to make sure of two things about which there can be absolutely no compromise. Their families need to be protected financially and in every other way that we can help and assist their families. There should be no compromise about that, ever. And second, this place has to be sanctified. This place has to become a place in which, when anybody comes here, immediately they're going to feel the great power and strength and emotion of what it means to be an American. We have to do that and not worry about other things, because this is too important a place. In their memory, we have to do that.
Excerpts from Mayor Rudy Giuliani's farewell address this morning in Lower Manhattan. You can hear the speech in its entirety at WBUR.org. Click on special coverage. Jack Beatty, there's a Republican, Time Magazine's Person of the Year, framing up the season, framing up the tragedy and the aftermath in terms of American heroism, in terms of inviolable American values symbolized by the chapel near the World Trade Center site. And it's a voice that has found a huge following.
It certainly has. I mean, here's a man who's risen from the political grave, really. He had been just in one calamity after another in his personal life and his health and so on. You know, Time magazine tells the story that the night of the attacks, he returned to the apartment where he's staying with a gay couple, by the way. There's Andrew Sullivan's inclusive Republican. And instead of going right to bed, he picked up a biography of Churchill and started to read and was taking inspiration from Churchill's inspirational rhetoric about London during the Blitz. And he thought to himself, maybe I can try to infuse a little of that in New York. And according to the author of that biography, he said, what Giuliani succeeded in doing is what Churchill succeeded in doing in the dreadful summer of 1940. He managed to create an illusion that we were bound to win.
A crisis, a level head, and a very effective way of framing that crisis.
Indeed.
Jack, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston.